We'll spend this first segment examining water allocations in the Klamath Basin. In any year, that can be a contentious issue, and it appears it is always an issue for wildlife refuges in the basin. The assumption might be that a wildlife area would always get water, but that assumption would be incorrect. Jess Burns from our EarthFix unit is the reporter for the issue. She tells us there's always a bird or 20 in sight at the Lower Klamath National Wildlife Refuge, but really, there should be many, many more. It's one of six preserves in a complex of national wildlife refuges straddling the Oregon-California border. In this first story, we hear why, even in an unusually wet year, migratory birds in the Klamath could be left high and dry.
Driving around Lower Klamath National Wildlife Refuge is like being on bird safari. Guides today are refuge manager Greg Austin and biologist John Vredenberg.
I'm just starting to see the white-faced ibis.
Yeah, cool. This is the first I've seen them today.
Yeah.
Stay in your car, and the birds stick around. But step outside, this is a place of paradox. The wide-open landscape is a disconcerting contrast of wildness and impeccable human control. Gravel roads run along a grid of dikes separating wetlands from fields of wheat and barley. Irrigation channels, dams, and water pumps crisscross the landscape. The safari stops at a massive expanse of marshy field.
Yeah, that's the first time we've had water on that in years.
10 years,
isn't it? Yeah.
The coots, plovers, willets, godwits, grebes, and gulls have been loving it. But Vredenberg says by the end of July, the water will likely be gone. So the refuge, which was set aside by Theodore Roosevelt as a haven for waterfowl, is pumping the water away to force the birds to leave.
We can't afford to have a whole bunch of areas that is going to attract a large number of birds into nest and then pull the bottom out from under them because the water's not there.
This is the deep irony of Lower Klamath's place in the basin. The natural systems that once kept the land wet have long been altered, and now the refuge depends on Klamath River water deliveries from the Bureau of Reclamation. It's the federal agency that controls the massive Klamath Irrigation Project. Despite having enough snow and rain last winter to end the western drought, the refuge was given no guarantee of getting any more water this year.
You know, to know that you had this kind of water year, and the watershed is as wet as it is, and we may still be dealing with the same drought-like conditions that we've dealt with for the recent past history. I don't know how we manage for that.
Jim McCarthy of the environmental group WaterWatch says each spring, the Bureau of Reclamation gives water delivery estimates to farmers based on winter precipitation levels.
That same courtesy should be extended to the refuge because it's what allows the refuge to exist and fulfill its purposes. But the Bureau doesn't do that.
Reclamation says it is only following the law. It has long-standing water contracts to honor and also has to follow an Endangered Species Act document called the Biological Opinion. It's an instruction manual for protecting coho salmon and two species of sucker.
Do you feel like y'all have any kind of discretion at this point?
No.
No?
No.
That's Jason Cameron, deputy director of the Bureau's Klamath office.
In a nutshell, the 2013 biological opinion accounts for all of the water in the system and clearly articulates how much water can go when and where.
The opinion says the refuge will only get water in the summer if the fish have enough and the project farmers get everything they need. Reclamation doesn't know if there's going to be enough water left until later in the season, although Lower Klamath has started receiving some water in July. So who gets the water in the Klamath Basin? First the fish, then farms, and then, if they're lucky, the birds. Retired refuge manager Ron Cole says a complex history and politics brought us to this moment.
You want to keep the Endangered Species Act working and helping fish. You want to keep the economy of the basin functioning as best you can. If someone has to give something up, there's just not enough support to keep water on the refuge.
As a result, Lower Klamath and the hundreds of species of birds that use it are left with only the liquid equivalent of scraps. I'm Jess Burns, reporting from Lower Klamath National Wildlife Refuge.
That sound of the birds does indeed linger. This is the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio. At the six preserves in the Klamath National Wildlife Refuge complex, there's a place for every bird. Sage grouse strut at Clear Lake, bald eagles roost at Bear Valley, and white pelicans patrol Klamath Marsh. But the populations here have plummeted over the past century. Recently, the major issue has been the lack of water. But in the second part of our series about the Klamath refuges, EarthFix reporter Jess Burns explains what happens when the refuges go dry.
A line of binoculars points upwards at a ridge on the edge of Tule Lake National Wildlife Refuge. There's an owl's nest in a small cave about 150 feet up, and Charlotte Kissling has her scope trained.
That's a male barn owl in the scope.
Oh, how do you know?
Females are tawny.
Oh, I thought it was winking.
Well, that could be.
The perpetrator of this comedy travesty is Kevin Spencer. He's leading the Klamath Audubon Society birding field trip to the refuges. Spencer doesn't get a chance at an encore because another raptor steps on stage.
Well, there's prairie falcon flying. Flying to the right. Way to the right. Way to the right. No, it's coming back. It'll come back.
Coming back around.
Coming back.
Oh, there he is.
The prairie falcon is flying right in front of you. Oh, boy. Look at this show, huh? Just enjoy it.
People travel here from all over the world to visit the Klamath Refuges, one of the best spots for birding in the United States. Kate White just moved to Southern Oregon from Georgia.
My species list, I write everything down, is so long compared to, you know, other places you go to see one specific species or one or two things, but not like this. We must have seen probably 45 species today, so pretty awesome.
But that abundance could be deceptive. There's a story going around the Klamath Basin.
I talked to people that grew up here, you know, the 20s and the 30s.
About the birds and how many there used to be.
Where the classrooms in Tule Lake.
That's a small town just south of the state line.
During the fall migration, the white-fronted geese were so numerous that the teachers would have to close the windows so that she could talk to the class. Because it was so loud.
Ron Cole is the retired manager for the Klamath Refuge Complex.
Now, if you see a flock of white-fronted geese flying over the town of Tule Lake in the fall, call it in. That's a big deal.
That's a bit of an exaggeration. But generally, that decline in birds is the story of the Klamath Refuges. Because the birds migrate, problems here likely aren't the only reason. But with no certainty, the refuges will get water each year, invasive plants are running rampant, and disease has killed thousands of birds. In addition, the refuges haven't been able to provide nesting habitat, says current refuge manager Greg Austin.
We're turning into more of a spring and fall migration stopover. Historically, you'd have water here in the summer, permanent wetland units that you'd get a lot of breeding birds, and we don't have that anymore.
John Alexander of the Klamath Bird Observatory has seen this loss in his work. Paddling on the Upper Klamath Refuge canoe trail, he's yelled at by birds perched on reedy marsh and green linoleum swaths of lily pad called rocus.
We'll just tuck up into this little channel and sit tight for a little bit and hope that some of our black terns show up.
For a decade, the observatory tracked migratory black terns that nest in and around Upper Klamath. While the terns' numbers have remained relatively stable elsewhere, they declined here by nearly 10% each year. Alexander says bird populations could be used to determine the health of wetlands.
The consequences for society might not be as apparent as they could be. All of this represents clean water downstream, and all of this represents healthier watersheds that hold more water in the long run in a climate change scenario.
Retired refuge manager Ron Cole has another old story about the refuges. It goes like this.
It's 12 o'clock, the birds got up, and you can't see the sun because there's just so many layers.
But without that memory,
I worry that when people are looking out there now, this is good. But if they knew there was an opportunity to see many more birds, would it matter to them? Don't know. Maybe it wouldn't. Maybe just seeing a few is enough.
I'm Jess Burns reporting from the Klamath Basin.
This is the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio. We're airing all of Jess Burns' series about the water or the lack of it at the wildlife refuges in the Klamath Basin. Jess Burns does work for OPB through the EarthFix unit and actually is stationed in our newsroom here at JPR. If you drink organic Northwest beer, there's a decent chance you've tasted barley that was grown on the Klamath National Wildlife Refuges. The farming of grain on refuges is relatively common across the country, but the Klamath refuges are the only ones that allow for row crops as well, like potatoes and onions. Allowing farming on land set aside for wildlife has been controversial, but as Jess Burns reports in the final installment of the Klamath Refuge series, the practice has resulted in an interesting new direction for agriculture across the Klamath Basin.
Lower Klamath and Tule Lake National Wildlife Refuges are giant laboratories, places where ideas are tested, both for the birds and for the farmers that are allowed to grow crops here under federal law.
I mean, this soil, it's like potting soil. It's pretty good ground.
For example, here's a problem. Sometimes when you're farming on a wildlife refuge, geese eat your tender alfalfa sprouts, says farmer Ryan Hartman.
We had a field down here that the geese were in pretty good.
So you experiment. Hartman deployed a squadron of scarecrows, but instead of straw men, he used what actually scares birds in the Klamath Basin.
We put up little plywood eagles to try to get them to, you know, go to a different field.
But the bald eagle cutouts didn't work. The geese hung around.
They don't care about it. But when the real eagles came in, they weren't in the field anymore.
It was an experiment that didn't prove the hypothesis. But there's another experiment on the refuges that actually did. And it's called flood fallow, or walking wetlands. The problem is, the refuges can't get enough water to support habitat for waterfowl. So wildlife managers convinced farmers to use agricultural water to periodically flood their fields, says refuge biologist John Vredenberg.
You know, what the farmers are doing, from our standpoint, we have all these agricultural parcels spread throughout the refuge, and they're helping us bring the wetland conditions that have been lost at the landscape scale.
Good for birds, and as it turns out, great for farmers. Fourth-generation Klamath Basin farmer Mark Staunton says after a year of bird poop and decomposing wetland plants, he saw fertility skyrocket.
When we take it back out and go into production, we're all of a sudden back to production that, you know, maybe my great-grandpa would have seen when he first started farming on the lake.
Staunton's great-grandpa was one of the first homesteaders in the area. His uncle was the first to work with the refuges on field flooding about 15 years back, and now Staunton is using this method to lead another transformation on the refuges. He's using field flooding to convert thousands of acres of land to organic production.
I'd say 5 years ago, our farm was probably less than 15% organic to conventional, and now we're about 50-50, if not a little bit more.
Fields that are flooded to benefit birds for three growing seasons can immediately be farmed organically once they're drained, meaning farmers that stick it out get fewer weeds, less plant disease, and premium prices for their crops. About half the farmland on the Klamath refuges is now either organic or flooded as a wetland. And as growers are seeing success using the system, other farmers off refuge are jumping on board, says Rob Wilson with the California Extension Service.
We've seen a substantial increase in organic production, and we're talking thousands of acres. So it's becoming a substantial part of the farming here in the Klamath Basin.
As organic farming spreads, there are fewer chemicals being put in the ground, which is better for birds everywhere. But Bob Hunter of the environmental group Waterwatch says this decades-long experiment with farming inside the Klamath refuges has been flawed at its core.
Walking wetland system certainly has provided the refuge manager with a tool to make an awful situation a little better than it is.
Hunter says the refuge's priorities are skewed, and the evidence of this is actually easy to find. Take those plywood eagles.
They have silhouettes of bald eagles planted out there to act as scarecrows to keep migrating geese off the fields. So here you have a national wildlife refuge that is excluding birds so you can won't adversely impact farming.
His is one of many voices that say if the refuges truly care about the birds they're supposed to be protecting, the next great experiment will be to phase out farming altogether. I'm Jess Burns at Tule Lake National Wildlife Refuge.
And this is the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Jess Burns joins me in the studio now for a little debrief about this. We kind of lived with this story in the newsroom for quite some time.
Months.
But fascinating stuff, though, on so many levels. I mean, when you get out there, the sound of the birds at the beginning of the first piece just kind of told a huge story all by itself.
Yeah. You know, I even missed the peak of the spring migration. But when I got out there, I was amazed at just how many birds were there. And then I had all these people saying, this is nothing. You know, there should be so many more birds here. And it was just kind of an eye-opening moment for me, even being out there and seeing that and being so impressed and just being told, like, you know, nothing.
I have to assume there's more water out there now than there was, say, 5 years ago. But so were the bird numbers even lower then?
The I don't know within that time frame what the difference of in bird numbers is offhand, but you know, during those drought years, the refuge did go dry. I mean, it was cracked, it was parched. This year, in July, Bureau of Reclamation did start delivering some water to the refuge, a small flow, and so they have been able to keep some of those wetland units with water on them that they haven't been able to in the past. But the problem is they didn't know in the spring that they would be getting water. And without knowing, you can't make a plan because these are wetland units. You're growing crops just like a farmer, right? And so you need to know in advance what the conditions are going to be or have an idea in order to plan effectively. And that's the big rub here.
So, and it was Bob Hunter from Water Watch who was one of the last people to speak, and he talked about how getting more organic farms and getting the farmers to flood the stuff that they farm on the actual wildlife refuges makes an awful situation better. I mean, what does any other group like Water Watch want to see happen there? Are they talking about some firm allocation of water eventually to the refuges?
I mean, I think they would like that. What they want is the wildlife refuges to be for wildlife. I mean, they said, you know, this was put aside for waterfowl. Farming is contrary to that.
So no farming at all.
I think they would probably land somewhere in the middle. I think they definitely want to get rid of row crops and probably quite a bit of the other stuff. There's two different kinds of farming. There's lease farming, which is the row crops, and then there's this co-op farming, which is more grain. And part of the co-op farming that is common on all the refuges throughout the country, or many of them, is that the farmers leave grain behind for the birds. So there is some benefit there.
Jess Burns from our EarthFix unit is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We just heard her entire three-part series about water allocation on the Klamath Basin Wildlife Refuges, which is, it's not assured. They don't have water assured for those refuges. But I have to believe that given this area east of the Cascades and the rain shadow of the Cascades, this was always a seasonal place anyway. I mean, even before anybody started doing anything about building dikes or diversions or anything, that there probably were times when these refuges did go at least a little arid.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the biologist at the refuge said the death of a wetland is stagnation. So you don't want water always flooded, and you don't want water always dry. You want this fluctuations and every 20 years there was expected to be a cycle of wet to dry. And so the system evolved with that sometimes it would go dry and different kinds of wetlands would be created. There's the equivalent of old growth wetlands, right? You have these tule growth wetlands. Then you have these tenuous wetlands that flood when it rains a lot, and then it comes back down. But you get you get plant growth there, and then you have these middle of the road, and you need all three of these for the system to be healthy, and that natural cycle would have provided for all of that. Yeah, there would have been dry years, definitely.
Let's talk about two kinds of life there, because birds first, that's the one that people tend to focus on. I mean, when there's no water available for them in the refuges, do they die? Do they leave? A little bit of each?
Well, the ones that go there when there's not a lot of water, they'll be concentrated in one area, and botulism and cholera has broken out, and that will kill thousands of birds.
Because they're all hanging out in this little bit of water with
exactly
all their poop around them and everything.
Right, and then the water gets tainted, and one bird gets it, and they're all in close quarters. And then, you know, at the height of the drought, they were seeing thousands of birds die at a time. Now, birds, you know, they're migratory birds. They can fly. They can go and find different water. And the thought is that a lot of birds do just kind of pick up and go other places. There's really no good way of tracking that. But there are lethal consequences for not having water on these refuges. It happens.
Okay, so that's the birds. Let's deal with the plant life there. That apparently has evolved over time as the water situation has gone where it's gone.
Yeah, sure. The wetland plants there, you know, there's these huge seed banks in the ground, and when the water comes in, they grow. Even if there hasn't been a wetland plant there in 20 years, all of a sudden you'll get these wetland plants popping in, which is really, really interesting. But then we've had such prolonged dry spells, and it stayed dry for so long. You have all these upland plants, these plants that like the drier conditions and other like farm weeds as well come in, and they've established themselves. Well, the way that that system would have naturally taken care of that is it would have flooded them out. Well, there's no water to flood them out. So you have the lower Klamath is just covered up in henlock, like all over the sides of the roads. You got these thick, just masses of hemlock and other, invasive plants that should not be there. And plants that the birds don't rely on, that aren't good for the birds to as habitat, basically.
So the ecosystem is different itself.
It is different, and that's just another way that the refuges aren't able to provide good habitat. Even when there's water this year, you know, there's not enough to keep those flooded out for, you know, a year or two at a time to really knock them back and let the wetland plants take hold again.
If you think of the Klamath Basin as a link in a chain, or if you will, an airport on the West Coast, the Pacific Flyway for migratory birds, I mean, do the issues here, I mean, they must have an effect on migratory birds generally, I would think.
Yeah, you know, there's issues everywhere. A lot of these birds are going down to South America, Central America. And so, of course, there's habitat destruction that has happened everywhere along the flyway. To give you an idea, the stat that I heard was that Lower Klamath was larger than all of the Sacramento refuges, like down there in that wetland system combined. This is a huge amount of area, and it's kind of a bottleneck for all the birds. They kind of come through here. You have this wet, marshy area. You know, I've heard that 75% of the birds on the Pacific Flyway, if there's water in the Klamath refuges, they'll stop there. 75%. And this is a massive flyway, one of the three big ones in the U.S.
Well, that speaks of the importance of the Klamath refuges, and obviously we have not heard the last of the discussions about how much water, if any, should be allocated to the Klamath Basin refuges. Good job on the series, three parts that you can find online at our website, ijpr.org. Jeff Burns works for our Earth Fix unit. Good to see you.
Thanks.